Friend PR comes from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com.
Contains greetings and eight.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For several years now, the debate over student achievement has shifted away from the students to the person at the head of the classroom, the teacher. Fair or not, they are being judged by how well their students perform, and that has upped the ante for teachers. They have to be at the top of their game, finding ways to stay inspired and to inspire their students, ways to be innovative while sticking to the assigned curriculum. With that in mind, Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools has partnered with Davidson College and UNC Charlotte by creating this Charlotte Teachers Institute, an effort dedicated to cultivating exemplary educators. But who decides which teachers get to participate? What exactly is this program providing that the school district or ongoing teacher development is not? How will this translate to student achievement? And what happens to teachers who don't get to participate? Ann Fox is a professor of English at Davidson College. We asked her to join us to help answer those questions and others. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Also, we welcome Susan Trammell, associate professor of physics at UNC Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Beth Lazier is a visual arts teacher at Mallard Creek High School in the CMS system. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having us.
And Scott Gartland is executive director of the Charlotte Teachers Institute. Good morning to you.
Good to be here.
Where did the idea for the Charlotte Teachers Institute come from? How did it originate? How long has it been in existence?
The idea for the Charlotte Teachers Institute came from teachers in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools in 2005. It's modeled off of a national initiative out of Yale University. And actually Beth and Jeff Joyce went up to Yale in 2005 to take part in their summer initiative where they were taking seminars led by Yale faculty. Mm-hmm. And they came back and were so enthralled, brought the idea to Ann Clark and said, we need to have a local institute here in Charlotte, and worked for years until we actually had one in 2009. Was when we formed the Charlotte Teachers Institute with Davidson.
So are you like a nonprofit? Are you affiliated with Davidson College? Where do you exist in the scheme of things?
It's a cost-sharing partnership where Davidson, UNC Charlotte, and CMS contribute funds to support the program, and they each contribute about a third of our operating expenses. And so our offices are out of UNC Charlotte on the main campus, but we have seminars at Davidson College mm-hmm. and UNC Charlotte with teachers. So it really is a cost-sharing partnership.
And how many programs, for lack of a better term, how many programs like this are there around the country? Is it just this one and the one at Yale, or are there others?
There are not many others like this. The Yale Initiative has five local institutes throughout the country: Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Newcastle, Delaware, New Haven, mm-hmm. Connecticut, of course, and Charlotte. And there's a new one coming up in Richmond, Virginia. And the strength of the model is the university-school partnership, where university arts and science faculty lead seminars, content-rich, intensive, long-term, for public school teachers. And I think one of the defining characteristics is that it is intensive. It's 7 months. We spend here with teachers and professors working to develop curriculum for students. And so it's not coming in one Saturday for 4 hours and leaving. It's they meet 13 times in person for 2 hours in addition to one-on-one consultations. And so it's unique.
Scott just gave you credit, Beth, for helping to bring this to Charlotte, this idea to Charlotte, because of your experience several years ago at Yale University, where mm-hmm. this has been going on for a while. What was it about the Yale experience that lit you on fire?
Well, I got to go back to school, and I got paid for it, which was a great initiative. It was like nothing I've experienced with professional development. It really allowed me to use my strengths, my knowledge, and develop something specifically for my classroom. It basically acknowledged that I know what's best in my classroom, and so we're going to share some information, and together we're going to come up with some ideas. Well, I came up with the ideas for my classroom, for my students, but it gave me that sort of empowerment as a teacher. You know what's best in your classroom, therefore we're going to let you write the unit. We're not going to tell you what to write. And so it was an enrichment on a level. My first seminar I attended was on ancient Mexico. And so I got to experience a real deep level study on that particular subject. But then it was up to me to sort of figure out how am I going to share that with my students.
So, and why would you in an art class?
Well, because I teach ceramics, and there is a great ancient history of ceramics and the development of that.
Now, so you just said several things that sound like heresy in the modern educational, public educational world, and that is, I know what's best for my students in my classroom. Who do you think you are? Are you in the superintendent's office? Are you in the state superintendent's office? This goes against the grain of everything that I'm hearing from teachers who are complaining about the fact that they do know what's best, but they're not allowed to pursue those ideas. Why are you?
Well, and this is why Charlotte Teachers Institute, I think, has grown as rapidly as it has, for sure. It has given us a voice. It has given us opportunity for not only personal enrichment, to give our students a deeper understanding of particular topics. It's also given us a chance for leadership and given us the voice. I mean, it's given me opportunities, not only like this one here today, but it's just opened the door for me in a million ways that I would have never expected when we started this back in 2000.
But how do you get away with it?
I got a good smile. I don't know. I mean, I think that what we do and the work that comes out of what we do in the end speaks for itself. My principal, my other teachers that I work with in my school hear me talk about it, see the work that we're doing, and they get it. They understand on another level that that's really what teachers know is best. Is giving them a chance, giving them time, which is something that CTI does for us. It gives us time. It allows us to think deeply and creatively, explore lots of possibilities of units and ways to present ideas to students that are challenging, that are innovative, that speak to them directly because I know my students. Mm-hmm. The superintendent doesn't, you know, he doesn't know my students. So,
okay. Well, I want to come back to that because we talk to a lot of teachers over the course of a year here, and a lot of them have the same complaints, and they're not able to do, they think, what you're doing, Scott.
And I think one of the great things about the model is that the units that Beth is talking about, the teachers write, have to identify the Common Core state standards and North Carolina essential standards that the teachers have to teach in their given classroom. And so it's very much aligned with what all educators are required to do. It's just that the partnership with the university faculty allows them to go deeper into those standards than they may otherwise. And particularly with Anne and Susan here, they get to access the current research or current criticism on a given topic where teachers may not have access to that, being so busy and have all kinds of responsibilities in the classroom.
Let me bring Anne Fox from Davidson and Susan Trammell from UNC Charlotte into this conversation. We have an English teacher in Anne. We have a physics professor in English professor in Anne, a physics professor in Susan. Talk to me about what's in it for you guys, because you're working with high school teachers and your university professors.
So it's not just high school teachers, which I found really fascinating. Okay. I'm teaching a seminar this fall. The seminar is about energy. Mm-hmm. And so I got my list of teachers. We've already started our seminar. This is a long commitment for both the faculty and the teachers. We started back in April. I got my list of teachers. I have elementary school teachers. I have a second grade teacher, all the way up into an AP physics teacher. So this is a very broad audience. And the first time I taught one of these seminars, it was a little scary for me to go into the classroom knowing I had this diverse range of backgrounds. But they worked together, and to watch them interact with each other, and the kindergarten teacher giving an idea to the high school teacher, and the high school teacher giving an idea to the middle school teacher. It's an amazing process. And for me, it gave me the opportunity to watch these teachers interact and talk about how to address this student and how to get this point across. And honestly, I've carried some of that into my college classroom.
Well, I was going to ask
you,
because you're a teacher too.
Sure.
Does it go both ways?
Absolutely. And I think that's why I like this model so much, is that the teachers have we have a lot of time to discuss and talk about content, and that's the beauty of these seminars, is that it is content rich. We are talking about physics and energy in my seminar at a level that most teachers have not done before and do not have access to. And so that's very valuable for them.
And how does that help them? Because it's you're teaching this at a university
yes.
level. They're going to take this back to the high school, middle school, grade school level. What does this immersion in your level of expertise do for them at that level? Because their students aren't ready to grasp this in many cases.
No, but I think it gives them the ability to explain it at the level that's appropriate for their student. If they have a complete understanding of the subject, they are much better at explaining it to their students. They are not doubting themselves. It also gives them confidence that they understand the subject and enthusiasm. That's the part that I really like, is that they really take ownership of the material. They take ownership of the content. They get excited about it. And they try things in their classroom that they wouldn't have tried normally. And many of those things in the sciences have to do with laboratory experiments, demonstrations, the hands-on stuff that kids love. But often teachers don't feel confident enough to do in their classroom because they haven't had the opportunity to do it themselves. That's where I come in. I give them the opportunity to explore in the lab, do things. We do experiments that are appropriate for them at a university level, and then things that they could do with their kids in their classrooms. And to see them get enthusiastic about it and know that next week they're going to walk back into their classroom after we meet on Thursday night, and on Friday morning they tell their kids, "You will not believe what I did last night. It was so much fun." And to take that enthusiasm about the sciences, about the arts, about English, is just an amazing thing for us to see as faculty.
And Fox, you've been nodding vigorously while she talked. Translate that into English, since you're the English professor.
I shall. Well, I think I would say ditto to everything Susan has said. And in terms of the humanities, I think there's also a richness to that seminar experience. I came to this program because it appealed to me to work with teachers as fellows, not as people who were my students, but who are my intellectual peers and who are innovators, who are thinking interdisciplinarily, who are going out of their safe houses of academic identity and taking risks. So, for example, I'm leading a seminar right now. This is my third local at the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, mm-hmm. and it's called Imagining Modern Bodies, Disability and Art at the Beckler Museum. And one of the wonderful things about that seminar is being in the Beckler, being in a local arts institution and having it be at our disposal to sort of, as a sort of forum for education and exploration. But in my seminar, I have a range of K through 12 teachers. I have a chemistry teacher. I have a kindergarten teacher. I have English and history teachers. And they're all taking that content and using it in the ways that suit their students. So the chemistry teacher is doing a unit on should scientists be responsible for the adverse effects of drugs they develop and talking about bioethics. The English teacher is doing a unit on tropes of blindness in literature and inviting her students to think critically. The history teacher is deepening her survey of global world history by bringing disability and the history of disability into it. So they all take what we start with, which is sort of thinking about disability and art, and translate it for their students and their subject in ways that are appealing, innovative, and exciting for them.
How are the topics for the seminars chosen? And I take it they're different every year, right?
They are, yes. We have a teacher steering committee, which includes 11 CMS teachers who all have experience in our program, having been through local seminars and participated nationally, so that they feel really comfortable about the model. And Beth can speak to this too. They collect ideas from other teachers around CMS schools and bring that to us. We go to find faculty who are expertise in those areas. And then ultimately the teachers make the final decision which of these lists of seminars are we going to offer this year.
I'll get Beth's reaction to that in a second, but we have to take a break for just a moment or two here, and we'll do that right now. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC State University's Jenkins Professional Online MBA program, offering accelerated and flexible course plans to fit any schedule or location. Information at mba.ncsu.edu. Well, for the last several weeks, Moral Monday demonstrations have brought thousands of people to Raleigh and resulted in hundreds of arrests. The demonstrators are protesting a number of policies enacted or being considered by the General Assembly on issues ranging from education to taxes to health care and more. And we're going to take a closer look at who these protesters are, what they're upset about, and meet one of those arrested tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than a million Brazilians throughout the country are protesting rising prices, high taxes, and government corruption. What the demonstrations mean for Latin America's biggest economy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Charlotte Teachers Institute, which is a cooperative effort among. That is correct, right? It's not between. It's among.
Indeed.
Thank you very much. CMS, Davidson College, and UNC Charlotte. Ann Fox is a professor of English at Davidson. Susan Trammell is an associate professor of physics at UNC Charlotte. Beth Lazier is a visual arts teacher at Mallard Creek High. And Scott Gartland is the executive director of the Charlotte Teachers Institute. He was talking just before the break, Beth, about these seminars and how they're chosen. You started off your experience with this years ago at Yale, brought the idea to Charlotte. How many of these Charlotte Teachers Institute programs have you been involved with since then?
All of them.
So how many different seminars? First of all, when you say all of them, mm-hmm. how many of those have there been?
Well, we started our first round of seminars in 2009.
Okay.
And so that's
four?
Yeah, well, and this is our sixth, is that correct?
Okay.
I was trying to review that. This is our fifth year, so... I've participated in four nationals, and then locally I've participated in every one that we've offered. So
okay.
I've,
and how many different seminars do you take when you participate? Because there are lots of different seminars.
There are, but you sign up. The teachers sign up for one seminar, and that lasts the core for that period of time.
Because you're the one that mentioned time, having the this gives you time.
Mm-hmm.
How does this give you time? You're teaching, you're grading papers, you're planning coursework, you have your personal life to deal with, and you have to go to these seminars. How long do these seminars run? How much time does that take?
Well, we started just at the end of this school year, and we ran four seminars, and then we have sort of a summer reading period, essentially. So those initial seminars give us an opportunity to talk together, to think about how we can take these topics into our classroom, what kind of research we want to do. And of course the seminar leaders are at that point giving us as much information as possible. Right now I'm taking a seminar called Urban Encounters, and it's a literature-based seminar. So I've been racking my brain thinking about what kind of literature do I want to bring into my art classroom to help my kids fulfill this idea that I am developing right now. And so I've been gathering text, images. I'm an art teacher. I keep thinking that way. I'm gathering text that I'm reading over the summer, and then we will pick up again, help me, Scott, late September. You know, we need a little bit of time to get school started, and then we pick up every Thursday night. So it is actually time, because my free time, I'm a reader, so it's something I just sort of do naturally. So all of the reading that I'm doing right now up in, you know, through November is going to be really geared towards how can I make this fit into my unit? How does this work? How can I have this help this work with my students?
From what you know about public school teachers in the system, is this something that every teacher would like to do? Or would there be some teachers who would be reluctant to do this or wouldn't be interested in doing this?
Definitely. I mean, there
definitely
is a,
what?
Definitely there would be some teachers that would maybe not be interested in doing this. There is a big time commitment. I think one of our challenges, and we've sort of been in this reflective period this last year as a steering committee of we're growing, we're becoming very popular, but we're also not connecting with certain schools that are part of our list of schools that we can get teachers from. And so we're trying to sort of address, why is that? What can we do about that? What is it about our model that is not appealing to some teachers? And I think one of them definitely is the time commitment. I mean, I'm done teaching at 2:15. I can really leave my school if I get all my work done, maybe at 3:30, 4 o'clock. And then I would drive up. I'd be driving up to Davidson and taking seminars. So that's kind of an exhausting day. I don't get home until 10 o'clock at night. But there is the other side of that. Is it is appealing to a lot of teachers like myself who want to keep learning, and I need a forum for that. I can do it within my classroom and for my students. But, you know, on a higher level thinking, and as Scott was saying and Susan was saying, these are sort of contemporary, this is what's happening now in the university systems. And we're getting the most current information from these seminar leaders. So in that sense, you know, those teachers that are driven, I think, would.
Okay, Anne.
And I think one of the things that keeps me coming back is to see the joy and intensity with which teachers seize on that 2 hours every week of intellectual engagement. They really become a community for each other, both in terms of talking about their pedagogical strategies, but also about their units. And, you know, teachers are so busy and so overworked already that I think this 2 hours, even though it sounds like, oh gosh, they have to go to all this extra effort, it actually becomes a place of respite and invigoration that they have marked out in their day once a week.
Well, because this is extra time for you, Anne, and extra time for you, Susan.
These
seminar classes that you're conducting, I suppose you conduct them differently than you do college classes,
yeah.
But still.
Completely.
Yeah, we teach them as – I teach it as an overload. We both teach as an overload. And
what does that mean?
That means it's in addition to my regular course load at Davidson. And for me, there's a kind of invigoration I get, both in terms of intellectually. I mean, this has fed back into my classroom and made me a better teacher, but just also in terms of the invigoration of contributing to the public good. I don't have children, so I don't have children in CMS, but contributing to the enrichment of public education is something that we all benefit from.
I think that I do teach this very differently than I would, say, an introductory course in college. And one of the things I really like is that the teachers control the agenda. I'm trying to, in some ways, serve their needs. They're telling me, these are the things I'm encountering as I'm teaching this curriculum that I need a better grasp on, that I want to learn more about, and then I can design the seminar to address those needs. So it can be very individualized.
Does that happen in advance, or does it happen during the seminar?
Actually, it's happening now, because they just wrote their first draft of their idea of the things that they're interested in. We had these three seminars where I was interacting with the teachers this spring, and I did some basic introduction of subjects to them just to make sure everybody had equal footing and sort of understood what we were going to talk about. Now they've given to me their idea of the things they want to pursue and learn more about. And then at the end, the final product is they will produce a curriculum unit about that subject that then they will present to their students. So we're right in the middle of that. I'm reading those now. They turned them in about a week ago. I'm reading through those, and that's guiding me and telling me, what are we going to do in the fall? Do I need to bring a guest speaker in? Are we going to go to somebody's lab? What should we talk about on this Thursday? What should I put out there for them to read this summer?
Mm-hmm.
I do most of our reading. It's a little different than in the humanities, that I don't usually have a book that they read, but they read various articles from different magazines about, in this particular case, solar energy, wind energy, nuclear energy, and which topics we focus on. That's completely up to the teachers. I might throw my 2 cents worth in on a couple of things that they may not know about, and I'll say, you know, it would be really cool if we talked about this particular new area. But overall, they're driving the agenda, and that really engages them. And it's fun for me to watch and see what it is they're interested in, what's driving their enthusiasm.
I think it's very liberatory for us as professors, too. We get to deal with adult learners in a different way. We're not evaluating for a grade necessarily, but we're still drawing on those ideas about critical thinking and interdisciplinarity that we love to transmit to our students. And my seminar has also been determined very much so by my fellows' interests. So the kinds of things we're reading come right out of what do they want to explore about disability.
If I have the full list here, there are eight seminars listed here on this piece of paper in front of me. Is that the general number of seminars each time you get together, just eight different seminars on different topics?
In 2009, we started with four seminars, two out of Davidson and two out of UNC Charlotte, and then because of teacher interest, increased to eight, and we've been doing eight for the last 4 years.
So how many teachers can be involved in these eight seminars?
We have 13 teachers, K through 12, in each of the eight seminars, so 104 teachers are in a cohort in a given year.
How many teachers in the system?
A lot.
Thousands.
Yeah.
So how do you choose, or how are the teachers chosen to participate? Because this seems to me to be kind of an elite thing. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean that if you've gotten into this, that's a pretty nice thing to achieve, it seems to me.
Yeah, certainly. It's a great privilege and responsibility to be a fellow in the program because of the work and opportunities I think it creates. So certainly in 2009, there were 50 teachers in the program. And I think the responsive nature of the model was such that, well, we have more teachers that are interested, so let's add seminars. Mm-hmm. Over the last 2 years, we've had a 55% increase in applicants to the program. And so as Beth was talking about, the steering committee is saying, how do we handle more and more teachers that are interested? Because, certainly we've said, well, let's just add seminars. Why don't we have another seminar at UNC Charlotte and another seminar at Davidson for 10 or 20 or 30? Certainly, we need to bring on more community partners to do something like that. But the program is I think it meets the needs of every teacher in that what Anne and Beth and Susan were talking about, because they get an opportunity to develop curriculum when they want to, but they just don't have the time.
How do you find the teachers at the university level?
The professors,
the professors to be part of the seminar, to conduct these seminars.
We word of mouth, and we work with department chairs and the dean of liberal arts and sciences, Nancy Gutierrez, and Clark Ross, and Carol Quillen, and Joan Lorden, who are very interested in supporting the program. And we, now they know about us, and so now we get recommendations all the time from faculty.
Teachers who have participated in this program report, I'm told, feeling very good about themselves because they feel as though they're being treated like a professional, they're learning something among colleagues, which you said, Anne, and they report feeling intellectually enriched. But a recent study conducted by UNC Charlotte reports that strategies for ensuring accountability among teachers have increased competition among teachers and decreased trust and morale. Now, this is a separate thing from you guys. This is what's happening in public education. But can it be argued that programs like these that elevate certain teachers and give certain teachers opportunities other teachers don't have are exacerbating the problem? Because you're giving these teachers a leg up.
One of the great things about the model is 104 teachers participate every year, but every single teacher in the system is part of a professional learning community at their school, at their grade level, in their department. And our teachers share their units and their ideas with others. And so it's not – the model itself is very kind of co-participatory in terms of the teachers develop these ideas. We publish them on our website for everyone to see, and we really want the information out there. So if a third grade teacher develops a unit for her students, the expectation is that she shares that with her colleagues, and her colleagues can use that with their students.
Does that, in fact, happen in the real world?
Absolutely. Well, of course, I can only speak for myself, but I have a department at Mallard Creek. I work in a department with seven other teachers. They know what I'm doing. They have also some of them have participated in seminars as well. But I'm sharing the kinds of things that, Friday morning, I come into school, and as Anne was saying, guess what I did last night? Mm-hmm. Guess what I learned about? This is what we were talking about. Have you guys read this article? We do a lot of sharing of that kind of thing within my school. So I think that maybe indirectly, we get a lot of teachers are hearing about what's going on, and that kind of experience can be shared. And they know where to go look for these units as well.
And also we hear about things like, for example, one of the teachers who was in the first seminar I did on depictions of science in theater took her unit on Miss Evers' Boys, which is the play by David Felcher about the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, and took it outside her own biology classroom and made it a school-wide event connected with a day about social justice sponsored by the Echo Foundation. Mm. And so that's a very real example of how a teacher took something she did in my seminar for her class and ultimately was adapted by the entire school.
You said that teachers, Beth, know where to look for these units. Are mm-hmm. these units, once you go through these seminars, is the material published in some way so that every teacher in the system can have access to
it? Absolutely. The Charlotte Teachers Institute website, all of the units since 2009 are posted online. And so you can look at different seminars that were offered since that time. And then within those seminars, you can find 12 curriculum units.
But I mean, if you didn't get to topics. Some of these are science-based. So if you did not get to participate in person in these experiments that you conduct and share with teachers, how can they carry that back to their science classrooms?
They do a really good job. Part of the curriculum unit that they write contains content. It's information. So if they're doing a specific topic in their classroom, part of the curriculum unit they write is about that subject. And so they have taken the content that I've given them. Often they use references that we've used in our seminar, and they put those in the curriculum unit so that any teacher that reads that is going to get a little bit more background on that subject and is going to be directed to other resources that will help them understand that subject. So in that way, we definitely disseminate the information beyond the seminar.
And what happens to teachers who do apply to get in but for one reason or another don't? Because you can only accommodate a little less than 200 people a year. So there are literally thousands of teachers. I don't know how many apply. How many do apply every year?
Last
55%.
So how many? Last year we had 152. The year before that we had 135 teachers.
Applied. And how many can you
accommodate? 104. We admit.
So what happens to those who don't get in for whatever the reason? Maybe they were late submitting their application. I don't know. We'll talk about criteria in a second. But what happens to the morale of those teachers who want to do this but can't, don't?
Well, I imagine it. For me, I would be really disappointed, of course. But I think that it's one of the things that we are absolutely trying to address right now. We're currently in our steering committee meetings thinking really critically, actually, about how do we expand our program to reach more teachers. We're gaining in popularity. People know who we are. Teachers know who we are and what we're doing mm-hmm. and are interested in this kind of thing. So it's something that, you know, we're 5 years old and we are now dealing with growing pains. And the amazing support between the universities and CMS and the Charlotte community really has given us a lot of ideas, and they're all actually, we are exploring them as we speak. We're looking at summer opportunities for teachers, expanding the program. I think one of the things that we learned early on, and this comes from our experience of following the Yale model and sort of learning from that program, is growing for the sake of growing, getting bigger for the sake of getting bigger, is not always the best and smartest move to make. So we are being careful about this. We're only 5 years old. So I think it's really important that we think about those things carefully.
And also, you know, it's I would echo all that. And I would also say Davidson, CMS, and UNCC have a really great working relationship on this. And another set of the parameters, of course, is bringing additional faculty in, you know, and in an age when university and college faculty are being asked to do more and more. Right. So there's a lot of moving parts. And so to try to grow too fast when all these moving parts are at play can be a risky prospect.
I'd say something else too, and I know there are teachers that don't get into a seminar. Often they try again the next year. But also, the Teachers Institute and community sponsors have sponsored a number of other events beyond these seminars that the public, that teachers from across the district are invited to attend, the Exploding Cannons events. These are events downtown. They explore usually a panel discussion about a current event or some topic of interest to the teachers. Anyone can come to those. So that's often a good introduction to the CTI model for teachers, is to come to one of these events, see what it's all about, and then decide if they want to pursue a seminar.
That's Susan Trammell, who's an associate professor of physics at UNC Charlotte. Ann Fox is a professor of English at Davidson. Beth Lejeure, visual arts teacher at Mallard Creek, who's on the steering committee for the Charlotte Teachers Institute, of which Scott Garland is executive director. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Billy Graham Library, presenting Rooted in Prayer, Biblical Truths for Everyday Living. The exhibit presents a closer look at teachings and examples of prayer now through Friday. Details available at billygrahamlibrary.org. Edward Snowden left Hong Kong for Moscow a day after the U.S. made a formal request for his extradition. WikiLeaks says it's helping him seek asylum in Ecuador. And Diane Rehm and her guest will talk about the diplomatic and legal twists in this NSA leakers case coming up at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you had like to join our conversation, there are several ways to do it. Among them, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
The Charlotte Symphony's Summer Pops Finale honors Independence Day with Celebrate America, a patriotic concert featuring Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, the music of John Philip Sousa, and more. Plus, fireworks following the concert at Symphony Park next Wednesday evening, July 3rd. Details available at charlottesymphony.org. WFAE is pleased to be a media partner.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Ann Fox, Susan Trammell, Beth Lejeure, and Scott Garland about the Charlotte Teachers Institute. We have all the partners at the table here, CMS, UNC Charlotte, Davidson College, and the Charlotte Institute itself. What's the criteria, Scott, that you use to select from the applicants those that get to go to this? Because you get more applications than you have people that than you can handle.
Mm-hmm. One of the most important items of the criteria is that the teachers are classroom teachers, and so that they're working with and leading classes for a majority of the day. There are many roles and responsibilities in the public education system that are critical, obviously, to the success of the students. And this program has looked at the classroom teacher as a very important and maybe the most important part of the student's success. And so being a classroom teacher is really important and one of the main criteria that we use, that the teachers are teaching K through 12 and we like a variety of topics, and so English, math, science, elementary school, art. We really do try to create seminars that are not only interdisciplinary, as Anne and Susan have mentioned, but that are across all the grade levels. So in a given seminar, we shoot to have about a third elementary, a third middle, and a third high school. When we're when Beth and the steering committee are reviewing the applications, they're very mindful of building seminars in that way to enhance that collaborative experience of learning.
So when you sit down, is it like casting a play? Do you sit down with resumes and applications and try to match this person with a seminar until you run out of seminar seats, and then you got all these leftover stacks, and you see if you made the right decisions and maybe take somebody out, put somebody in, and you're left over with a stack of people that don't make it? Is that how it
works? Yes. Yes.
Okay.
The teachers apply in February and March, and they can apply to as many as three seminars. And so particularly if they have connections to many different topics, they could apply to Ann's seminar, to Rolf's seminar, and to Brenda's seminar this year. And so the admissions committee reads in reading groups. And again, the admissions committee is made up of 11 teachers on the steering committee. And we have seminar coordinators, and those are sort of teacher leaders that work very closely with the professors in the program to support the logistics of the seminar. And so this year we had 19 teachers in a room on a Saturday, doing some prep work beforehand, reviewing applications online, coming together and sort of doing the very, very difficult work of evaluating all of the quality teachers in that who have applied.
There is also – I mean, Scott is very good about making teachers allowing or facilitating teachers having access to us. So there is an event in February where teachers are able to actually talk to us about the seminars we might be leading and sort of, I hate to use the analogy speed dating, but it kind of is a speed dating thing where we sort of talk about, well, what do we envision and how might that translate for your classroom? So it's not as though the applications kind of land in our laps without the teachers having engaged with the faculty about the seminar itself.
Yeah,
I want to come back to something that Beth talked about, and I'd like to hear from all of you about this, because the Charlotte Teachers Institute model is used as a way of, I guess, helping teachers develop, as you said, their own curriculum in the classroom, because teachers know best about what their students want to know and what their students need, and also best, it seems to me, about how to teach the material that has to be taught, because the system says you have to teach this, because every student is different, and you deal with these people every single day. You get to know them. But when you're developing your own curriculum, when you're deciding that I went to this seminar, for instance, on grammar for the real world, well, that may be different from what the English department says or the state English curriculum says you have to teach. So how do you incorporate this new material, this slightly different material, into the material that you must teach because you've got to get these kids to pass these tests?
I think you have to give a lot of credit to teachers. We are innovators in, and this model really allows us, because it does take time to figure out how to make this work within the guidelines of state curriculum. That absolutely takes time. But if you've ever written or read, I should say, the Common Core Standards, I mean, that's not really creative writing. And it's, you know, the presentation of those things. And so to have the time to think about these standards that we need to address and in a way that is that, as you said, our students are going to hear us. They're going to understand it. They're going to have gone through the process. So I think it's just a matter of allowing these ideas to sort of fester and grow and talking with other teachers. The best ideas I've come up with in the units that I've written have really come from conversations that I've had with other teachers within my seminar when they say, oh, have you ever read this? Or I used to do this one experiment, and I'm an art teacher, so last round of seminars, I actually took a science seminar. I was completely out of my element. But this is just kind of to my point, is that this sort of creative thinking outside of the box in ways to reach students with the information that we need to reach them, that needs to get to them, but in a way that we know as teachers, as instructors in the classroom, as people that have relationships with these people, these students.
I'm going to jump in with one thing there, too. Just to give an example, I think we need to give credit where credit is due, and that's with the teachers. They're incredibly creative people. The last seminar I taught was an astronomy seminar. We were learning about the solar system. And I had elementary school teacher, actually, she was a first grade teacher. Her specialty was actually reading. She worked with kids and teaching them how to read. And she came up with an incredible unit about she'd taken all the content that we had learned about astronomy, scientifically accurate, and she created a whole set of leveled readers, books for her kids based on this content and illustrated it. It was really fantastic. So she had come into this classroom, taken all this science knowledge that made her a much more confident teacher, created her own set of little readers for her kids that she knew they would love and that she could get them to read.
So she's killing two birds with one
Absolutely.
Stone.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Education.
Very interdisciplinary and very, very creative in the way she went about it. And I think that as a faculty, my job is to deliver the content that they want and give them the information that they need, and then they can take it from there.
The two of you, and I know you want to talk about this, and you go right ahead in a second, but the two of you are college professors, and you have a lot of freedom, it would seem to me, in the classroom to do whatever you darn well please and teach whatever you think is right for these students and what your areas of expertise happen to be. You are not faced with the same stringent curricula rules that high school, elementary, middle school teachers are faced with. Are you? I mean, well, do you sometimes look at these people as being crippled in their efforts to teach what's right?
The first thing I would say is that I think we're all, as educators, actually being asked increasingly to sort of talk, to sort of show that what we do has application in, well, quote unquote, the real world.
The governor would like you all to teach so we can get jobs at the end of the college.
Well, I think, you know, as recent debates about the humanities have shown, things like critical thinking, thinking across interdisciplinary boundaries, being able to be an innovator are all skills that all students need regardless of the discipline they study. And so I think I would echo what Beth and Susan both say, and I would say that this isn't about a program that allows people to get out of, you know, teaching the things they're supposed to teach. This is a program that allows teachers to innovate and bring their fullest fruition,
I was going to ask Beth, and I'll ask all of you, in the best of all possible worlds, in the absence of the – because I had teachers like this. And I know that I went to school when the dinosaurs roamed the earth. But I had a teacher who once came in and had us write a book report in sophomore English. And she gave us all Fs because we couldn't write. Mm-hmm. We had terrible grammar. So it was supposed to be American literature that mm-hmm. year, and she threw it out. We never read a single book. It was all mm-hmm. diagramming sentences and grammar, and it was the best thing that ever happened to all of us. Now, you couldn't get away with that today. I'm sure you couldn't get away with that today, but she did what she thought was right, and she was right because she was dealing with the students she had in front of her.
Well, and that's what we're asking teachers to do, is to say, what do you think your students need, given the series of parameters you work within, their needs, their level, the Common Core standards, expectations, assessment, but do it in an innovative, creative way. And they do it. They absolutely do it.
And does this translate to the students? When the students see you on fire about something and you're able to transmit that enthusiasm, whatever it may be, is it infectious?
I think so. I think anytime you have a teacher that stands up in front of students and is smiling ear to ear or talking a mile a minute about a topic that they're passionate about, kids listen. I've never had an experience in my years of teaching, where I've had a student that didn't notice my excitement or energy. I'm a pretty loud teacher. I'm pretty vocal. I move around the room a lot. And when I'm excited about something, my kids know it and they respond to that. And the deeper my knowledge is, the stronger my confidence is in presenting these ideas and having them challenge me with thoughts and ideas, which is what I'm getting really directly from the university professors that are teaching these seminars. Is I'm being challenged in a way that I'm never really challenged. I'm challenged teaching my students, but I know that I've been doing this for a number of years, and I sort of have a routine and an expectation of how they're going to challenge me in a variety of different ways. I mean, I put on a different hat every minute, it seems like, in my classroom. But what's happening when I'm in seminar is I'm being challenged in an intellectual way that is that opportunity is just not available elsewhere. And I've been teaching, as I said, for a number of years. I will not say how many. However, I haven't had this kind of intellectual challenge in my teaching career.
Wow. So. She just talked about confidence, Scott, and you that harkens back to something that you have said, that as a result of attending your seminars, teachers gain knowledge of their subject and increase their confidence in their ability to teach it. And as a result of the seminar, they have a higher expectation of their students' ability to learn. Explain that last part. I understand the confidence because you're gaining all this new knowledge, this in-depth knowledge that perhaps you didn't have before as a teacher. But how does that translate into higher expectations for students?
I think that's a really good question. I think the great thing about our model, I think, that it doesn't gloss over the transformative element of adult learning. And so when you're going through things, it's critically important that we're focused on the standards that the state sets and now the nation and the district. But it's a human endeavor, and it's people, and it's students, and it's adults. And so we don't want to just go too quickly to the students in terms of assuming that we have a parameter that we can say this was working and this is not working. And so our model, as Beth was suggesting, is really about the teachers transforming themselves and gaining the knowledge so that they can then bring that to the students. And that's critically important because there's no amount of magic dust that you can just sprinkle over someone and they learn all of a sudden. It takes a group of people, an individual, to inspire that person.
Do you agree with that statement, that it raises your expectations of your students' performance?
It Yes, I do. I also would add that it's one of the difficulties that we face because it's not something that's really measurable in the ways that the state, the district, the nation is wanting to have the measurement.
Well, that was my other question. This has been in existence for 5 years, and you've given out the number, but I cannot keep numbers in my head. So you've given out the number of teachers who have been through this. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to quantify in any way what kind of a difference this has made, not for the teachers, but for the students that they teach in the system?
Yeah, certainly. We collect student data on student proficiency scores and growth scores, and the teacher students in our program are performing better than the district and the state on those indicators. But we also do a ton of work interviewing teachers and going into classrooms and going into seminars to observe what the process is like so that we can paint that really complete comprehensive picture of what it's like.
Are the teachers who participate in this from CMS, are they from all areas of CMS, all the locations of schools around the area evenly distributed in some way? Are they from the high-performance schools, the low-performance schools, the high-income schools, the low-income schools, etc.?
Yep, it's certainly geographically and socioeconomically representative.
And the same student achievement happens in the classrooms of the teachers no matter where they are?
Absolutely. The students in the program are the teachers are working really hard and are really trying to accomplish meeting the expectations that the teachers are setting. And so as the teachers raise their expectations of their students, we're seeing that their achievement is also increasing.
How has this changed the way you teach and the way your peers who have been through this program that you know about teach?
I think it has opened up a world of collaboration that's really not ever happened before. Within my school alone, I think we have six teachers that applied and got into seminar this year, and from all different curriculum. And so the idea of collaborative learning, not only with my peers, but then also our students are going to sort of, that is maybe an indirect association, but our students are going to, you know, leave my classroom and go to the science classroom or go to an English classroom and start to have a sense of these teachers that have this learning thing going on that they're doing. And so that the collaboration has really been the thing that has, on a lot of different levels, been transformative for me as a teacher.
Beth Lejeure is a visual arts teacher at Mallard Creek High School. She kind of brought this idea back from Yale University, has participated in every Charlotte Teachers Institute seminar series since its inception, and is on the steering committee. Scott Gartland is executive director of the Charlotte Teachers Institute, a collaborative effort with CMS, with Davidson College, where Ann Fox is a professor of English, and with UNC Charlotte, where Susan Trammell is an associate professor.